Hi, I'm Josh, and after adding Galaxy's Edge, the next land that Disneyland is going to add is going to be Ghostland, and I just can't wait to ride the Exploding Testicle Teacup ride. I guess teabag ride, yeah.
Having just listened to, I'm Matt, and having just listened to Josh's intro, I am now haunted.
This is Charlie Down in Austin. I had to pull some strings to stay awake during one of the movies, and the strings I had to pull was watching over multiple instances, and then the rug got pulled out from under me, and I still ended up falling asleep. So the strings pulling was all for naught.
And instead of doing the show tonight, we're just going to give you a 5-minute montage of putting together a music track. And this is Horror Show Hot Dog. So we had talked about watching a short called The Chase. And usually we have, like, Charlie and I rely on Matt posting that on our website. And our website was down. And so we all watched a different chase. And so we're just not going to talk about it because it would just be like a one of those where, well, it seems like we all just kind of watched a different movie, except we actually did.
I will point out that at least I got to see both Charlie Sheen and Henry Rollins.
Mm-hmm.
So that was good. Not the right thing.
Is that weird ass? Yeah.
Yeah. Mid-90s, The Chase. Yeah. Sorry. Mm-hmm. Trying to make a joke that did not land. All right.
I got there. I understood that reference. We just watched The Paper Chase instead. It'll be fine. On a chaise lounge. It's fine. We'll talk about instead Prisoners of the Ghostland or Prisioneros de la Tierra de las Fantasmas. This movie stars Nicolas Cage, and that means different things to different people, and certainly different things than it used to, like 20, 30 years ago. And it's kind of a Mad Max-ish, but a little more metaphorical and dream logic-y thing. Like, there is a guy in this post-apocalyptic thing who is recruited from prison to go save the governor's daughter, and he's equipped with a suit that has explosives in it, one on each ball in case he gets too horny around the daughter, one on each arm in case he thinks about hitting the daughter, and one on his head around his neck because if he fails to find her in 5 days, they're going to blow his head off. And from there, it gets kind of wibbly-wobbly thingy-wingy, and I really couldn't quite put it together by the end of it, but there are a lot of beautiful costumes and there are a lot of people really heavily overacting, and it's I don't know, like, I'm just tired. I'm tired of Nick Cage. I'm tired of him. God love him. He's been in some good movies, but it's just like, now it's, we're going to stick him in a movie and at some point he's going to do the screamy thing, and it's kind of boring to me. Like, he needs an M. Night Shyamalan Sixth Sense style to come in and go, okay, here are the things you're not going to do in this movie, like you did with Bruce Willis. It's like, here are all the things that you're known for. But now it's just like, here he is, he's going to go nuts. And like, if you enjoy that, you enjoy that. But like, yeah, I don't know. So I had a hard time getting through this.
Have you seen, Josh, have you seen Pig yet, by the way?
No, and I don't want to.
You really should, though. Because he's probably, if there's any justice in the world, he'll get an Oscar nomination for that movie.
Do you actually bring it in?
It's really fucking good.
Okay.
It's really good. It's like, because I hated Mandy for like 15 different reasons. Mm-hmm. Not the least of which was that the kind of pitchfork AV clubs of the world just think it's so great. And it's just sort of like, it's like, if you like something, you're doing it intentionally, not because you actually like a thing. You're just trying to make a point for some fucking reason. So, like, I'm always mistrustful of that crowd to begin with. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, but mainly it was just sort of like, I mean, there's one scene in that movie I really loved, and then the rest of it is just like, God damn it. It's just so stupid and long and ridiculous. And so, yeah, like, sometimes you get a little bit of, like, a little bit goes a long way. But it's like, but in the, there's a kind of a, there's kind of a, like a sad sort of quietness about the, about Pig, where it's like, it's just sort of like, well, it's, I don't think it's good to say too much about it, but it's just basically just like, it's like even the things about what it's not about kind of a movie, where it's sort of like, ostensibly, like the tagline is, guy who has a truffle pig, pig gets stolen. He just wants to get the pig back. And like, that's basically, it's the sort of the framing, but it's like, but it's really good. And it was like, really got me thinking for a while. And it's like a much more quiet and understated and actually acting kind of thing from him. Cause as much as I love the man, it's like, there are times when, you know, it's like, oh, it's a bit much, but Seon Sono is that way too. Like, you know, I mean, I really admire him, but he is amazing at finding a nerve and then just pounding the shit out of it. Like, you know, cause he did Tokyo Gore Police and he did Cold Fish and he did, Tokyo Tribe and Why Don't You Play in Hell and Love and Peace. Like, he finds a nerve and then just goes, yeah, and then just jumps on it. And it's just, you're like, and so if it clicks and works, it really is a wonderful feeling. But it just, like, he doesn't seem to really care if it actually clicks for you or not. He's just gonna do it anyway.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I've been on record in previous episodes of saying I've even considered Nicolas Cage as like a vulnerable adult, right? Yeah. Because it just seems like he's so unhinged in his performances, and I've come around from that differently. However, I do think that that means what we are going to get when we get Nick, you know, we're going to get a lot. And it's not that I think it's out of his wheelhouse. I think he just knows what he signed up for and he knows what they're paying him for, which I think speaks to your point, Josh. I think this is a movie that was just interesting enough to keep me involved. And, but definitely, you know, like, It is just, yeah, it's Mad Max. It's whatever.
And well, it kind of reminded me more. It reminded me more of, like, instead of Mad Max, and you know, if you think that's okay. But yeah. I was come. My takeaway more than anything else was less Mad Max and more of like a. It almost had like a Terry Gilliam kind of a feel about it, where, like, I mean, I admire Terry Gilliam, you know, his films and his creativity, sure, and all this, yeah, kind of stuff. But there are, and, you know, I'd be the first one to say, there's some dead air. In a lot of Terry Gilliam's movies, where they become kind of hammock-shaped at times, where you're like, okay,
so
let's pick it up a little bit here.
Then, does this make sense? Because the other thing was, because I went, Mad Max, I think, is the easy pull, right? Like, that's the most on-the-face type thing. But then also, I felt like I was landing on Judge Dredd.
Oh, mine was Six String Samurai.
Six String Samurai, yeah, yes, absolutely. Absolutely, that's a great pull.
Yeah, good, yes, pull, Joshua.
Absolutely, and I was just like, okay, and so I just kept trying to recalibrate as I watched, because it was like, if I just have to watch this on its lonesome, then it is it's a cornucopia of references with which I don't know it has any, you know, stabilizing force in the middle that's holding it together, right? Like, there's no content. Mm-hmm. But if you just go, all right, you like all these things, we're supposed to just shut our brains off and have fun. Okay. Then the fun becomes pulling out the references, I think. And, or at least that's one way to,
well,
you know, consume.
Well, and this was, and also too, you know, I mean, actually, I think you're right on the money. And I would, to that kind of, that's kind of thinking on that, I think it kind of goes back down to the director. Like, he's just like about color and about style, and sometimes, like, there are sequences, and I swear to God, I think, like, I don't know how many of his movies I've seen over the years, and, like, you know, sometimes at festival settings too, where that can sometimes color a little bit, but you kind of go, like, none of this is sticking together cohesively, but, like, yeah, okay, and just kind of go, and it's like, but other times, other directors and him too, like Love and Peace took me, his Love and Peace one is like, it's way sentimental and very, very sweet, but to a crazy degree, And it's sort of like, at times, it's like, so it took me a while to calibrate to that one. But I think it's just kind of his thing. Like, in Ghostland, it's like, you know, just overwhelmed by these, like, by the costuming and these sets and stuff. And, like, all this just ridiculous amount of just everything that's getting packed into this sucker. And it's sort of like, and then, so then my brain just goes, well, why couldn't you have made at least one character like a person, like a normal person? And it's like, but then it's that same thing as like certain musicians who there's vocal stuff on their music, but they're like, vocals is not really about like lyrics so much. It's like, it's just like an instrument. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of like, and so I almost wonder if maybe that's the thing with Seon Sono, is that he just like, you know, like, why don't you play in Hell is another amazing one. If you've not seen that one, where it's like, it's kind of about like the breakdown of the wall between the creator and the work as far as like making a movie goes. It's sort of, but it's like, at a certain point you have to accept that like these aren't people and you just kind of go with it. And sometimes I'm able to do that myself, you know, but other times I can't hang, and I'm just like, give me a character, write a character. Damn it. Like, I don't want a tapestry. I just want a person that you've written. And it's like, and so this one just didn't really have, like, daughter, the girl he goes to rescue, played by the always great Sophia Boutella. It's like, you know, it's like she was the closest to a human, I think. But
well,
it's, but I think that's it. Yeah, there's no audience entry point for this, really. And then the tone of it is all over the place.
Yeah,
like some things are meant to be very serious. And there seems to be a very like serious point being made, but then it's like Nick Cage's ball blows off and he holds it up in his hand and makes a funny face. And then he's like standing on the car and says, I never thought I'd be here. Missing one testicle! And she's like, what the fuck is happening in here? And there's nothing grounded in any kind of, I kept trying to get my head around the story.
Well, did that moment not feel like they were trying to do a This Is Sparta? And it's like, but you it's just a dude who got his nut shot off. You made it ridiculous moment.
It was so weird.
And he was apparently fine though, but it made me think of that acting style, that over the top acting style that you see in Japanese movies.
Mm-hmm.
I just had never heard it in English.
Yeah, that's
Oh,
yeah,
that's smart.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of got to thinking about that too, Josh. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
Like the anime style, you know, like
just like, stop acting, and then quiet thing. It's just like it's the deaf tones of acting. You know, like very loud, very quiet. Very loud, very quiet. But you know what's funny too is like that scene was I found that scene to be obnoxious. But then there's like 10 minutes later, he has like a superhuman.
Yes.
Super humane sort of moment later on, and he's like, well, why don't make it the movie about that character? I like that character so much more.
Yeah, like, that's the thing. I feel like despite itself, this movie kept intriguing me, you know, because they would do the big dumb thing, but then they'd have a moment, and I'd go, well, this is a different movie. Hopefully the rest of this movie's like this movie. And it wasn't.
Well, and the swings, but, too, are like,
you know.
Yeah, there's this, the swings of it. Like, I mean, everybody went completely sideways over Anneli Amanpour's movie, Bad Batch, which is her follow-up to A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. And it's like, I walked out of Bad Batch when I saw the premiere of that one, and I was like, and I walked out of it, I was like, I really dug it, and I was very surprised when people were like, no, that bleh. And I was trying to figure out why. What's the deal? And then it's like, it was kind of in this same vein where it was like this ridiculously crazy tapestry of these like desert dwellers and stuff, and then like, but you don't have like people. Like I'm rooting for Dave. Like Dave is my guy in this thing. It's like there's not a Dave in the movie. It's like it's just one-legged Sookie Waterhouse, and then like all these kind of kooky characters and stuff. And it's just like, but it's got a lot of ennui to it. And but anyway, I just thought it was kind of interesting, a fascinating deal. And in this one, like the best moments are not the loud big moments. They're like existing in this crazy, like, you know, all the guys like holding the rope, keeping the clock from moving, and then like you have Ratman and all his crowd, and like the if you watch in the background, it was really fascinating to watch Ratman and his people, like their physicality in the background, like not even when they're at the forefront of a scene, like they have this like very specific physicality to it. And you have like angelic lady with the white dress, and then you have like all these like crazy kind of characters, and it's just, I don't know, it's just so much going on where it's just like yeah, this really jives in as like a sales kind of deal, where it's like I have 53 ideas and you're going to get all of them.
I wonder if this, like Bad Batch, would have played better if I had seen either of them in a theater. Because there's something about a spectacle like that that's a little light on the logic or the relatable characters. If you can get a big enough screen and a good enough sound system, you can kind of let it overwhelm you, and then it's really fun.
Well, that was the way it was with Tokyo Tribe. I mean, like, that was...
That makes a lot of sense, yeah.
That was probably... I would say Tokyo Tribe would be probably in either my top 5 or top 10 most favorite theatrical experiences of ever, because it was just, it's so much goddamn fun. But, you know, it's one of those things that I could see somebody walking in and watching Tokyo Tribe and being like, I'm really into this, like, for the first hour and 20 minutes, but I'm like, there's so much energy in this, and there's so much everything. Like, Matt, when you were saying the thing about the color palette in Prisoners of Ghostland, that's what I was like, oh, you need to watch Tokyo Tribe, because, like, it is every exploration of color and material and shine and noise and crackle and every fucking thing for like 2 hours, just like this assault. And it's like, and all this amazing hip hop music and this dancing and this choreography and all this shit. And it's just like, oh my God, man, how the hell you fit all this in there? And it's like, but I saw it at a theater. I was like one of the first, you know, audiences to see that damn thing. And like being an audience, you know, everybody doing the thing of like, you know, everybody's doing the Tokyo Drive, never gonna die. And then going back and forth. With him on stage, everybody, it's like, that's a thing. Like, that will color it forever, you know. And it's like, but I fully recognize watching it again later, down a couple years later, and I was like, whoa, this is a lot. Like, this is so much. So yeah, I think Josh, I think that was a very insightful thought, because like I think there's a lot to that, where these type of things, you know, can hit you differently depending environmentally or your mood wise too. And I just wish that the one testicle version of Nick Cage in this, I wish the more tender moments and the quieter human moments, I wish the movie was about that guy, because that character is much more interesting. And I think even if you played it that way, all this outlandish nonsense all around him would actually kind of be more palatable. I wonder if like you just have more grounding or just like one or two more humans.
It's just so weird because the guy says, like, if this explodes, it'll blow your arm off. If this explodes, it'll blow your ball off, right? And the arm one, when it explodes, just kind of scratches his skin a little bit.
Well, I thought he had to get a fake arm.
Did he?
Oh, yeah, maybe. I thought he got a fake arm.
Okay. I must have missed that in the mix, but... He is just like,
who can say?
He like holds up the ball that blew off, right? And then he's pretty much just fine.
Yeah, well, you can walk the rest that off. Of it. Yeah,
yeah.
Literally,
you gotta walk funny, but
well, you know, I mean,
I
think I have the same. I think I have either the same complaint or the same compliment for this movie, which is like, yeah, it is clearly not doing enough heavy lifting to be a serious movie, but it is also doing a great job of being just a bonkers movie. So it's just, you know, but it's neither bird nor beast, and so that makes it weird, whereas I think... as, you know, Josh and Charlie both pointed out, were I to watch this in, you know, whatever, like, THX surround sound, like, honestly, I'd probably ignore all the flaws and just be like, nah. And, you know, because, like, I've watched a couple terrible Star Wars sequels, like, you know, so I feel like that would let me roll over a lot of the things that I might have hang-ups over.
Sure.
I do think that there is, again, you know, as I often say with a vicious editor, there's probably a better story here, because I think, I can't remember which one you said it, the quieter moments of Nick Cage are better. So someone could have made that movie and it would be a realistic running time and could still have all the funny, crazy action moments, but lose the kind of dullard sensibility of just people taking too long talking about nothing. So, I think that there's a version of this movie that I'm just forming in my head where it's shorter, less drawn out, and best viewed in widescreen. And I think that's my ideal version of this. And that has nothing to do with this actual movie that exists in real time. So, your thoughts.
I admire the creativity. And I think you either need the really symbolic stuff, like the dudes holding back the clock, or the really gritty, realistic stuff. And putting them both together is just kind of a weird match. Mm-hmm. Makes me think of The Devil's Highway, too, where, the whole, metaphorical hell, literal hell. I mean, metaphorical demons. Literal demons. Oh, Jesus. So it just gets a little out of hand. I have got to the point, I think, after Malignant and this, if the majority of reviews use the word bonkers, I'm not fucking watching it. Because that is the word that is a thing that I'm just not that into anymore. Is the weird for weirdness's sake. And give me something like Turbo Kid, which is absolutely ridiculous, but has so much heart to it.
Yeah.
Then that is something that I would watch, but I wouldn't describe it as bonkers. I would say this is an insane premise, but it's really sold because of the characters and the people that you care about in it.
Well, then, are we talking about the idea that, bonkers is now a term that's used as an excuse for poor writing?
I think bonkers is just, the primary thing that recommends this movie is how weird it is.
Mm.
And I just can't hang with that.
Yeah, I think a lot of times a lot of the mainstreamier type of folks, when they're writing about this type of stuff, when they use that term or whatever, I just kind of go, I don't think you... I gotta channel my inner Mandy Patinkin. I don't think that means what you think it means. Sometimes something's bonkers. No, it's just loud. It's just kind of noisy. I think it reminds me of the SNL cast, the late 90s, where it's sort of garbage ass writing, but it was just loud. The fact that, Jim Brewer, a lot of these other people that were part of that group, it was just that it was fucking loud. Go back and watch some of the sketches. They're just god awful because it's just sort of it's just noisy as shit. And it's annoying. And so I wonder sometimes with bonkers, I think it just becomes this kind of, when I hear that kind of thing, or just like you say, Josh, I just kind of just become that seems like they're just kind of covering over, with the Todd Solz thing, it's it's very artistic. No, it's not. No, it's smug.
Yeah, it's just disgusting, and that tricks you into thinking it must be art.
Yeah, it's just I don't accept that. Try harder. It's just there's plenty of movies, and I think that's another thing. And I don't open this fucking can of worms because it's too late. But the other thing, I think it's one of the things outside of the actual material itself that used to drive me nuts about the Todd Solz thing is there's a lot of better things that came out when that Numbnuts was coming up, and it was sort of but he got a lot of the attention because is this very transgressive, for one thing, transgressive my ass, but then for two, it's just why put this crap up on a pedestal and make it a thing because it's very different, it's very, whatever, man, get out of here with that noise. And so I always kind of it's the Michael Jordan thing. Yeah, and I took that personally. It's just sort of, that's why it bothered me so much with the Todd Solz thing. And so, yeah, I kind of just think that the spectacularization is not interesting, but creative freedom can be very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. Whether or not it hits is here or there. I mean, we've had that experience with movies from other countries where there's cultural touchstones that we don't really get. Mm-hmm. But you just kind of go okay, I recognize this is a thing. I don't 100% get, but like, I want to kind of roll with it a bit to kind of see how we can, you know, kind of try to meet in the middle on stuff. And I think that's a different thing too. You know, it's like, that's just, you know, there's cultural touchstones that you just never really, you meet in the middle on, and that's perfectly okay. And so that's a different thing. So it's like, for every time somebody props up a Todd Solz, I go like, there are 10 filmmakers in 10 other countries that are 10 times better, but that, you know, and that people haven't even discovered yet, you know, and just sort of like, but this stupid shit's getting attention. And I kind of, yeah, I think sometimes that when you read those type of things, it's just sort of like they're trying to prop up something to kind of build their own self-importance, and it's just like, I ain't got enough time for that bullshit.
Yeah, transgressive is another...
Like, yeah, transgressive is hilarious. Yeah.
It means like the only thing that recommends this is that it's going to offend somebody's sensibilities.
Yeah, somebody, I saw that about Midsommar, and I was like, really? Is it really?
Yeah. Shamelessly overturning societal norms. Really rubbing it in our face that it's wrong to throw old people off a cliff.
it's like I think maybe you should recalibrate your definition of transgressive. I think you're looking for a movie like Salo.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, like, I have Criterion Collection versions of movies.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, like the, I mean, sort of like, you know, the devils. I mean, Josh and I have never agreed on the devils, and probably never will. But like, you know, like the devils is a good example of that. You know, like Asalo is a good example of that. Like, you know, fucking, you know, Ari Aster just sort of, you know, jerking off in a, you know, tweed elbow jacket. It's like, it's not transgressive. Thank you very much. So yeah, I just sort of like, and at a certain point, you know, like I said, that Pitchfork AV crowd, I can't hang with any of this kind of stuff. So like, you know, so when we get to a movie like this, like, it's just sort of like, it has a lot of flaws, but I mean, at the same time, like, you know, I go back to younger version of me with like some of Terry Gilliam's things, and, you know, just, you know, kind of diving into the weird and maybe like overlooking or purposely overlooking the flawed aspects of a lot of it. And, you know, just kind of, it's just one of those mixed bags. So it's, you know, I was still pretty entertained by this, especially when they just let it be quiet. And then it was really something to see.
It's one of those that I can't just write off because there's clearly a lot of talent on display, but I had a hard time getting through it. I think my text chain on that one was like, this is kind of excruciating. I'm sorry. Tell my wife I love her, you know. So I would say, like, for me, it's a 4 out of 10. I can get why people would be into it, but yeah. I mean, for a 4 out of 10, it's absolutely nuts. Well, nut.
Nut. Yeah, there you go.
I would say... I was surprised at how much I enjoyed this. I think it is not without its flaws. And I think, as we just discussed, it is a movie that was capable of being a better movie. Or at least had the bones of being a better movie. It just wasn't that. And so, you know, I enjoyed the parts I got to see. So I'll give it a 6. 6 out of 10. Let's see. 6 out of 10. This is better than going to work.
Yeah, I think I'll be the high man on this totem pole, which is perfectly fine. Like, I mean, you know, like I said, there's a lot of detractions, then the subtractions, and you care the two, and you see when the train leaves for Chicago, and you kind of do all the math, and, you know, but I'll be the high man on the totem pole. I'll say 7 out of 10. But I'm gonna say 7 out of 10. I want casting directors or people putting some things together to watch Sophia Boutella and say, yeah, she was really good in Hotel Artemis. She was good in, you know, Kingsman, Atomic Blonde, and these other kinds of things, and the stuff that she's been in. She's been really good in them. She's been very talented in general. That woman has got presence out the ear and the other ear, and it's sort of like, give her like some. You're like, okay, Atomic Blonde's a great example. Like, Charlize Theron is so fucking good in that. And it's like, because they're taking her seriously and her presence in the thing, and she has presence out the ass in that movie, because they're taking it seriously. Watch this woman act and give her something of really deep substance to work with. Like, God damn it. Like, just, it's just one of those things. Like, I hate seeing actors like this that, like, I love seeing her get to work and she's built up her career, whatever else, but, like, give her something substantial, damn it. Like, it's just, yeah, it just irks me. So I'll say all that out of 10.
By the way, if anybody who is listening to this hasn't seen Atomic Blonde, you should just stop right now and go watch that and then come back.
And then also Tokyo Tribe, but you know,
good different reasons.
Charlize Theron does not rap in Korean in that one.
Is this the time I should say I watched Atomic Blonde and hated it?
You can if you want to embarrass yourself in front of everyone.
It's just not the time, Matthew.
That was my goal.
Perfect.
So I would like to take a quick potty break, and then we will do the fastest. We'll do the Chris Berman fastest 2 minutes in sports on strings. After that, hopefully.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can't imagine we have anything to say about that. There was nothing. Well, nothing happened. So.
All right, we'll be back.
Oh, you noticed that, did you?
Might have picked up on it. All right, so, same thing. I'm gonna run downstairs and pee. I'll be right back.
So next we have strings or cuerdas. Someday someone is going to make a movie about depression that doesn't feel like it suffers from depression, and this is not that movie. Is the best I can say. So, like,
oh god,
before
damn.
I get into it, like, this is clearly really meaningful to somebody. Like, the person who made this is really trying to get across something about depression and artistic whatever, you know, ennui, or, you know, maybe even suicide. But it does play out as just this very zero energy. Everything's kind of icy and distant and not a lot of dialogue. There are these extended sequences of our protagonist who goes to her, like, aunt's beach house in, you know, the winter on the beach in New England to make her new album. And there's, like, extended sequences of her looping samples and making songs. And it's a good 30 minutes before there's even a hint that anything might happen. And then, like, very little does. And it's very, she goes on a photo shoot with her friend, and we just watch him take pictures for 10 minutes. And then later there's something in the background of one of the pictures, and it ends up being some kind of haunting thing that follows you and makes you commit suicide, I guess. And it, like, it's a metaphor for depression, but it is just, like, watching this movie is the experience of depression. Like, the live action Lion King was the animated Lion King with clinical depression. So, you know, as I was watching this, I was like, man, the only thing that I'm digging is it's fascinating to watch her make these kind of cool songs. And I was like, oh, Matt is going to hate this because Matt's going to hate this music.
You thought those songs were cool?
Yeah, and that's why I was thinking, like, Matt's going to hate this because Matt is going to hate this music. And the music is the only thing that's doing it for me.
That's hilarious. All right, yeah.
So, yeah, my experience with this was very... I have to read from my review. This is a slow, cold, slow, sad, slow, quiet, slow, patient, slow, very slow movie. This is my first sentence. Yeah.
Do you want to throw a number?
What did you think? It's like a 3.
Good lord, really?
Actually, I liked it better than Prisoners of the Ghost Land, to be honest. But it's right about the same. So, yeah, I would say, like, 3.5 out of 10. There were some things in it that I was into, but few and far between. There was also somebody else who I follow on Letterboxd had a review who absolutely loved it and said it just really spoke to that feeling of depression and that, like, there's just... this is the perfect winter watch and blah, 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 and we're super into it. And I had to respond, like, thank you for this, because it reminds me that people encounter things differently, and, like, this did not do it for me, but I'm so glad it did it for you. Yeah. And I think I managed to do it without sounding like a condescending jerk, because I meant it sincerely. Like, it is so interesting to hear, like, the dude who thought I am the pretty thing who lives in the house was one of the best movies of the year. Like, I want to hear from you, because holy shit, that's an amazing worldview. But yeah, 3.5.
Huh. All right. Josh, I think speaking to your point, it is more important, of course, to make sure that, like, while my opinion of this movie may or may not conflict with a listener, someone that deals with anxiety, depression, bipolar, etc. This seemed like someone processing that, right?
Mm-hmm.
It did not identify with me. And so, now that doesn't mean it's wrong, right? It just means it's different, and that's okay. But the experience of consuming it and feeling like none of it rang true was difficult. So that was tough. So I watched this movie, was bored out of my skull, and felt like I didn't know whether or not the person who wrote the movie knew what was going on. I know what's going on for me. But it felt like it was uninformed. I kind of shrugged my shoulders and was a bit disgusted. So I'm going to say 1.5.
Yeah, I just, this was a tough deal. Like, initially, my initial plan, we're going to talk about this, was I was literally just going to say, I was just going to be like, 2. One point because it's not Dear God No, and 2 because they tried to make a movie. That's it. But getting to thinking about it, though, like, I mean, it would be crass and unpleasant to sort of tell somebody how they're supposed to process a thing, and maybe this person was writing from the perspective of somebody in this position, or maybe they had firsthand or secondhand experience. I have no idea. But ultimately, like, all I can really do at that point is, like, take the material as it's given, and in this particular instance, the lady, the primary character in this, is like, we don't really know anything about her. We don't know enough, I don't think, at all to not be able to, like, oh, we have to root for her, we have to root against her, or, you know, whatever, make her pitiable, or nothing like that. But it's more just sort of like, we're not given anything about her as a human. And so, like, all of the endless meandering around, and like the early parts of it where she's like doing little bits of farting around with the machines and stuff, and then like not really getting much out of it, or not doing much, or getting frustrated or whatever, it's like none of that means anything to me watching, because I'm like, I don't really give a shit about this person yet. If I've been like, oh, she had some measure of success, had a backsliding, and then she's trying to recenter herself, and she's really struggling, that would give me something. Or like, just any other human component, but there's just none of it. It just drags. And then this is the part where it's like, I'm not going to begrudge anybody their process to process whatever they're processing. But ultimately, like, the horror or the supernatural elements in this, like, if it's a metaphor for depression, great. If it's a metaphor for this, that, whatever else, great. But, like, I was reminded of John Mulaney's very delicate approach to talking about Trump and the White House. Like, it's kind of like a horse in a hospital. Like, you know, sort of like, like, we don't know what to do with this horse in the hospital kind of situation. And I feel like the supernatural element was the horse in the hospital. It was like, there's a presence. And, like, okay, and? Well, it's like a thing. Is it a thing? Well, we're not sure if it's a thing.
And it makes you do a Cristo Redentor pose and then kill yourself.
Yeah, and it's like,
or someone else.
And on top of that, like, that was another thing where, like, were they suggesting that she did it, she was involved, she caused it, like, and then it just fucking stopped. And it's just like, look, I'm not going to begrudge your process, but the end process has to be a result of some kind. And it's just sort of like, and so get to the end of this and just being like, you have got to be kidding me. Like, I was channeling my inner Josh. Like, you have got to be kidding me. Like, it's just like, don't give me the end of this movie the way you get it. Don't just sort of blurf onto this thing some element of supernatural stuff that's supposed to be a metaphor. Like, no. This isn't ninth grade creative writing. Like, do better. Like, you got to do better. And so, like, I'm not gonna begrudge your process, but at the same time, I watched the thing that you finished with, and like, it just So I haven't been this irked by a movie in a while, and it's just like, it just really, really irked me. So yeah, two. Yeah. It's not Dear God, No, and another point for them trying. So that's it. Two.
That makes sense.
That's our D for effort.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, for effort.
I love that Dear God, No is become like our default for just like, nah, just don't.
Exactly.
It is such a rich
tapestry of piss and nonsense that like it just does the job of like setting that bar, right? Like,
I was gonna say that's a weird thing to say when Carnage for the Destroyer exists, but at the same time, Carnage for the Destroyer had a sense of humor. And it, like a little bit of energy to it. So yeah. I mean, it's different smells of farts, but
yeah.
I wonder if we watch the final now, if we would be like, this is actually kind of mid tier, it turns out. Because for a long time, that was our go-to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Getting the whipped cream rubbed on their face, and it's acid.
You caught a whipping.
Yeah, and then there's also ones that we've not done for the show where, like, I mean, there was the Alchemist Cookbook, which I fucking hated. I just hated that so goddamn much. And then there was, what was the other one? The chewing... All I can think of was the damn chewing. This L.A. douchebag made this movie and was super shitty in his intro, and I was like, oh, that's why. And it's just like, it was just...
Are you talking
awful,
like Deathbed Bed That Eats?
No. This was like four or five years ago, maybe a little longer. And the name will come to me eventually, but it was one that I saw during South By, and it was just like, it was just this like douchey director guy, and it's just sort of like, oh, you're not trying to eat while you're watching the movie. Like, it's like, motherfucker, I want me to list you all the movies I've watched while I'm eating a meal. Like, just shut up. And it was like, then it was just like all the slow motion stuff and like this intentionally kind of transgressive, you know, food related whatever. And it's just like, oh, just go walk off go to Long Island, find a pier, and walk off of it. Like, just get out of here with that. So, like, you know, there's ones that we haven't done, and, you know, blissfully we'll never do them. But yeah, we have
Slaughterhouse Princess will be the barometer. That, so,
just kick it over to them. Like, y'all deal with this bullshit.
They love a terrible long walk off a short pier. I do love our sisters from Slaughterhouse Princess. They're good folk, but yeah, it's just there's like a certain every now and then you run into a movie and you go, nah, like this isn't worth the 20 minutes of discussion.
Well, it's funny too because like the one I think of, and it tickles me to this day, and I can't think of the name of it, maybe it's better that I don't, but there was a short in year three of House Core, the last year the House Core happened, the year after Corey passed away, there was this kid, I think he was either from Chile or Argentina or one of those countries, I can't remember which one it was, and he really wanted to make a short film about a guy who keeps trying to eat stuff and then shit just keeps coming out of his mouth for like 20 minutes. And he's staggering around, and like he keeps trying to eat things, and out comes more shit, and then whatever. And it was like, I remember Mark Martinez and I were watching this and going like, what are we, why it keeps going, and it keeps going, and it keeps going, and it keeps expecting to stop, and it keeps going. And we're looking at each other like, what in the ever-loving fuck? And so then like the next day during the festival or else, I don't know where I was, but Mark ended up running into this young fellow that made the movie, and he was like so overjoyed. He was like, I wanted to make this thing about this, and then I got to make it, and I'm so happy that people get to see it. It was like, it's just like he was in hog heaven that he made this thing and made it the way that he wanted to make it. And we're like, it's like, but the movie you made, though, it's like, but he was just so happy.
Well, you just go like, good on you, and there are people who are going to dig it, and then you'll know that those are your people.
Yeah, exactly. And it was like, yeah, it's one of those things where there's that little tiny part of me that just remembers that happy South American fellow who made the shit movie, and it was like, he was so happy. And so like, I don't know, who the fuck what do I know?
Yeah. I mean, I had the conversation on the bus a couple days ago where I had to try to explain the short movie Curve. Which is really hard to explain, it turns out. But then had, like, once I had they were like, well, I don't think I want to see that. I think you're probably right. Because it was that good. But because that, I'm That's still funny. Fucked up about it. The reason I bring it up just now, as I told this person, was because it woke me up at 4 a.m. So it's that intense. And they went, thanks for the recommendation.
That I will not take.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, moving on.
Yeah, let's talk about The Hunt, or it's just Hunt. Yeah, the Perseguir. If you've seen Hellfest, you've already seen this, but this is a more different version of it, where the characters go, hey, let's go to an extreme hunt, because that's the thing that people say. And then they go to an extreme hunt where for a long time nothing scary happens to them. And then, as you might expect, the people in the hunt are trying to kill them for reasons that I feel like are never really explained. They're just
The reason why you feel that way is because they're not.
Yeah, so it's by the time we unmask a couple of them, it's folks who are like heavily body modified, which is always just like a fuck you kind of, because like the guy whose face is all tattooed to look like a skull is one of the nicest dudes in the world.
Yeah.
And like the lizard guy is a pretty stand-up dude. So, but this is that kind of like, yes, we're deviants and we're, you know, Rob Zombie decided he didn't want to make the movie about us, so this other dude is. I mean, there are a couple of creepy moments in this. I really like the dude who's like trying to reassure them that everything's fine, but still refusing to take off his mask. There are a couple of little moments in here that are like, ooh. But other than that, it's like, it's just Hellfest with less memorable characters.
Well, then, I don't like to do this, that try to minimize this part of our personality, but I have to just do a little bit of the teeing off on the rules, not seeing, because in this situation, they are lost, and then they pull off the side of the road, and then the sign turns on, and they're like, oh, well, we'll go over there. So that's the first thing. Hmm. Second thing is, they go up to this thing, and no money changes hands. Uh-huh. Even in the shittiest haunted house movies that we've watched over the years, money always changes hands. There's a ticket buying process, and you go into an attraction. Like this, all of these knuckle fucks. Like none of them. They're like, wait, did they charge us? Like, oh, that's weird.
Well, they do manage to surrender their cell phones and sign waivers.
Yeah, which is, that was another
like,
part of it. Was
at
like,
some point, I'd be like, at what point do I gain anything from this transaction?
Yeah, it's just like work. So. Like, just the set off from that part of it was so beyond baffling to me that like I got so enraged, and then I came down from being enraged just being confused. Like, why didn't you factor that in? Like, why was it like you go to the address for the extreme haunt and they go, oh, we go on this haunted hayride, blah 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 blah. But just something grounded in anything that would resemble logic, because it was like, and so I was super distracted like right from the onset, because I was like, what the ever loving hell, like god damn it. Like, Josh, you said it perfectly, like there are moments in this that do kind of have a little bit of a ooh, but it's just like, oh my god, I just like 10 minutes in, I was so mad.
I kind of wonder if there was a draft of this, an early draft in which it was supernatural. Like, the people running the hunt were supernatural. Because the way that the hunt kind of brigadoons out of the mist, right? Yeah, that's a verb now.
Joshua, for the win.
Oh, no, absolutely. No, I was fully impressed by your verb.
Yeah, that was fantastic.
But you are taking a leap in logic that I had not prepared myself for, but I think is actually fascinating. So I'm curious.
Because if you go, yeah, and so like the way that it appears is kind of mysterious. The way that the logic of it unravels is strange. Like the first dude that they unmask, I think maybe the second guy they unmask has the like full black contact lenses and, you know, the bumps under the skin and all that shit. And for a hot second, it's like, oh, so this is like demons haunting, you know, running an extreme haunt, like, then maybe there would be a thing there, maybe. But no, it's not that either. And it's just, I just ended up not having any idea what they were going for and whether they got there or not.
Yeah, I think this movie suffers from some of the same problems as Strings, which is just like interminably long scenes where there's just a person not saying anything, mm-hmm. and that's just boring. Like, I get that there is something to be said for like an impregnable antagonist. However, you know, if your protagonist gets 2, 3, 4 attempts at talking to the person and the person never replies, well, then that person is a piece of wood. Yes. So stop. Just move on.
Well, and then on, and then also the third act of this too, like, I don't know if they thought that was going to be this, like, yeah, but the whole thing of, like, you know, they get out. And then it's like, and then it's like, then she's doing the thing, the, you know, gets the guy, saves the guy, and then they're at the hospital. Then she's signing the thing, and then it's like, oh, well, the form, and then the address, and oh, we got to go back and get whatever. So, like, at that point, the movie goes back to their sound logic of the setup, and then goes, so there's a 3-alarm fire in a heavily wooded area, and nobody has responded. And so apparently that's not a thing that's going on. So then our girl, who's just been involved with this, I'm sure she got interviewed by the police, is going to slip out, go back, and then murder somebody in her house to get back at them.
Mm-hmm.
Because the cops wouldn't have gone there to protect her family if she had that realization. And it's like, and I don't like to use the L word, but it's like, that is so goddamn lazy. Is so goddamn lazy. Like, it's just, it's unacceptably lazy. Like, it's just sort of like, if you want to tell a different story, like, you know, Josh, you said it perfectly, like, the thing about the supernatural component, or like the actual demons, whatever, like, go for that. Yeah, go for that, for sure. You know, if you get these people that are dejected and they're, like, kind of a murder cult a la, you know, like, Devil's Rejects or whatever else, fine, like, tell that story, whatever else. But just don't be so fucking lazy in your setups that you want to get an oh fuck moment at the end, or a fuck yeah moment at the end. But we're like, you could do it 10 times more interesting or 10 other ways. I'm not the genius. You figure it out. Mm. But like, as it stands, having him like walk in the house, get stuck to the sticky stuff, then have her walk out with a shotgun, like, that's murder. Like, that's premeditated murder. So like, yeah, this person was involved in this, you know, kind of whatever else like that, but that's murder. Like, it's not interesting. It's really fucking boring. It's what an eighth grader comes up with. And it's just like, and so, you know, I don't like using that word, but I just sort of like, in this particular instance, it just, from the lack of money exchanging to ending up in the first place, that whole part of the setup, then like, apparently this entire town doesn't have a fire truck or a fire department, and then there's no cops apparently either. To the end part, I was just like, there's so many moments where they just said like, well, just throw some spaghetti and see what lands on the script. And it's like, and I find that very frustrating.
Well, then, okay, Charlie, I want to ask you a couple questions, or at least one, because I am currently writing one play and a show, etc.
That's cool.
Which are, right. But the whole point is to try to avoid those pitfalls, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, is it not more realistic to be, well, the answer is just, yeah, someone killed someone. Like, is that not perhaps a more satisfying ending? Because that, at least it pays off? Like, I'm trying to sue for peace on that side. Like, because I've got two different things in struggle right now, but like, part of me kind of goes, all right, so if it's just like, yeah, it turns out it was just like the, you know, ex-wife, all right, then it was just the ex-wife, but at least it will have made sense plot-wise. Now,
well, that's, I mean, I think that making sense plot-wise, though, like, I mean, I think you kind of answered your own question in a way, because like, if there's a motivation, even if it's a stupid motivation, mm-hmm. then there's a way to like make that jive. Like, I mean, I think about like You're Next, for example. Like, sure. I mean, the type of money you're talking about in something like Your Next, or even like, or even the movie The Simple Plan, even, or just most recently, Aaron Kershaw's new one, which everybody has to see, which is South of Heaven. It's like sometimes the or Cold in July is another one where like sometimes the object itself is small and it's hard to get to where you can the justification part, but at least it's there. You know, like there's something that's there.
Well, yeah,
I mean, like in this one,
there's a reason
she killed them.
The phrase MacGuffin, right?
Well, yeah, for sure. Well, because and like but that's it, why just, I think that's
all
why
that matters
one,
is it that it matters to the people involved, right?
Well, yeah, to a point, but I mean, at the same time, like, look at Blue Ruin. Like, Blue Ruin examines the idea of, like, somebody, a regular person, trying to figure out how to exact revenge and realizing that, like, there's a whole lot more to it than what a normal, normal human can do.
Yeah.
Like, in this scenario, she shoots the guy stuck to the ground, right? And then it's, like, in a shotgun, and blah, like, a big mess. And it's just sort of like, but... what is it, three of their friends are dead, or four, or however many people are dead?
Something like that, yeah.
Two alarm, three alarm fire, whatever else. So no police or even FBI are ever going to come to her house. So her ability to clean up this fucking mess and dispose of a body is not in question. For God's sake. You know,
yeah,
like it just...
That is true.
And not everything has to be. I mean, things can be fanciful, sure. I mean, not that, you know, I don't mean...
Yeah, but I'm just asking you, like, as a plot point, like... You know, does it matter if it's based on, you know, time span, you know, slash versus just the based on plot device?
Yeah.
You know, because I feel like there's room for the plot device. I do agree with the time span argument.
Well, and Josh would know, and Josh could kind of speak to this even I mean, much better than I can, which is sort of like sometimes there are mechanisms that like. Yeah, they're either going to rub like sandpaper or they're going to rub like silk, but they're a mechanism that like that serves a purpose, and you know, it's sort of like maybe that's it can be subjective.
Yeah, I think it just depends on what's come before, because I really liked that scene at the end of Haunt, but it was a scene from a different movie.
Yeah,
it's the classic.
Yeah,
it's the classic. Sydney Prescott at the end of Scream, like, this is when the killer pops up for one more scare, and she's like, not in my movie. Like, yeah! You know? But this just didn't match the rest of the thing.
Yeah, because that's not that character. That's another thing. That's another part of it. Like, I mean, you know, I don't open up this gigantic can of worms because we gotta go to bed soon, but, like, it's one of those things that's sort of like, I like it when movies treat death in a way... and murder in a way that like recognizes what death and murder are versus like, you know, I mean, I've watched 1,000 slashers, watched 1,000 more of them, but I do like it when they do take a moment to take a breath or three and recognize like how weighty the concept is. And this idea that kind of Mousy on the Wall is going to turn into Rambo by the third act is just, you know, it's so silly, and it's just sort of like, and so it's hard for me to cheer for her in that particular instance. Like, you being a Sydney Prescott kind of a moment or whatever, like, you know, she's actively being hunted, you know, and it's like, and there's something that's kind of satisfying about the setup of so many slashers from like the 70s, 80s, where Williamson and Wes Craven really did something pretty special with Scream. But like, that was what that is, you know, if you're trying to do something more. Not realistic, but you know, it's a different setup. Like, it just doesn't, as Josh would say, it just doesn't dog. You know, it's just it's just kind of, it's kind of a flatness to that part of it. I just go back to that beginning. Like, Hellfest wasn't great. It was okay. You know, Hellfest, Bloodfest, both of those. Like, you know, sort of like, it wasn't, they weren't great, but at least somebody paid for a ticket. At least there was some, you know, something.
So I think I've got Hellfest and Bloodfest and a third one confused, because there was another one where the characters went to an extreme haunt and they were like, I don't remember anything about it except
like, it was the house, another, the house that October built.
No, because there was that one too, right? Which was fucking terrible.
Yeah.
But the one where they were all like chained up, and there were chain link fences all over the place inside. Yeah. And
no, that's the thing.
Yeah, obviously super memorable. I've been going through our list, and I'm all the way back to 2019, and I haven't seen the title of it yet.
All the way back to 2 years ago.
Yeah. Which is dang. Which is to say that the concept here is not the freshest.
Yeah.
To that idea of like, dude, the extreme haunt dudes are fucked up and actually killing people. And for one thing, if you hang out with carny folk like we do, that's kind of hilarious. It's the idea that like the Renfest dudes are trying to kill you. No. Are they trying to sleep with you? Probably. But, you know, nobody's trying to kill anybody on the festival circuit, you know? It's just,
they're just not.
Especially like, oh, this guy has tattoos and piercings. Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Some of my best friends have tattoos and piercings.
Well, and it just starts to become like
a couple people.
Like at a certain, I mean, at a certain point, like at a certain point, watching through a lot of these ones, like there has to be a turning point where somebody figures the way to expand it outward. Like maybe it's not actually at the attraction. Is it one of the people that? That is going there and like stalking people and then killing them later, or maybe it's like a just there has to be a way to take it out of the framing and then move it somewhere else.
Well, doesn't the concept require it to have that moment? Because otherwise, what's the point?
Because all you're getting is these one fake night. Scares are actually real.
Boogaloo, and
that's all you can do.
Yeah, and then you all go to jail or whatever, I guess. Like,
yeah, because it was like, how many times are you gonna go? Like, you know, Six Flags is a new attraction.
Yeah,
one
exactly.
out of every 10,000 riders you have to get their head lopped off, and you're three. Like, I'm not going on that ride.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at some point you have to go to step three, profit.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, and that's why when you get somebody that has a creative or interesting idea about how to change how this framework works, like I mean, I would go back to Afflicted. Afflicted is one of those fantastic examples of like why are they
is that
filming
the vampire
like,
one?
Yeah,
yeah, oh,
the
God,
two guys
that
do the travel okay. one, and yep. like and like why are they filming? Like, well, they lay out how the mechanics of this work. And that just really, really clicks. And it's like, so there are ways of taking these framings and do them. Like, it's not me. I'm not the one writing one of these ones. But, like, I think at this point, the extreme haunt thing is, like, I think that got, I mean, was it Happy Birthday to Me or April Fool's Day, whatever, in the mid-80s?
I think Happy like, Birthday to Me.
I think yeah. they kind of nailed it then. And then I don't know how much more you're going to do. Like, Urban Legends... The second Urban Legend movie gets into that a little bit. Like, oh, the body in the haunted house was real. And it's like, and then how long ago was that? 15 years ago? 17 years ago?
Oh, it's at least 25 by now.
You know, so I mean, I think at a certain point you have to show ingenuity in how you're approaching these framings. And if you're not going to do it, then like, I mean, I guess there's a return to it. I guess there's some profitability to it. But I was like, I don't know. It's just, and Josh kind of hit it perfectly. Like, I couldn't remember one from the other one. And it's like, well, there's a reason for that. You know, it's like, yeah. Well, children. But then also, it's just like, they're not very memorable.
It just has to, you got to have good characters if you're going to do a really familiar premise.
Yeah.
And this didn't have that either. I don't remember any of the people really in this movie, and I watched it last week. So yeah, this kind of went in one eye and out the other, as I say. I'm now in 2018, and I'm still not sure what that other... But
oh,
it was another
shit,
extreme
I almost
hunt.
Forgot. Oh my God, I almost forgot. So at the beginning of this, they make a big goddamn deal out of being like... They're like, oh, they're going to exploit your worst fears. And like the one lady's like, I don't like spiders. And they're like, well, spiders are going to show up. But like, where was everybody else's? Like, you're like, baseball guy, like, my fear is people getting burned in the face with a poker. Like, oh, well, it's a face burn poker situation. Like, oh
that
man.
Commonly
they
known
got him.
Phobia, yeah.
Yeah, it's a very common, yeah, face poker syndrome is a thing. It's a like, so that was another thing. They just completely abandoned it. It was like it's sort of like, and you know, maybe that would have been contrived as well, but it's like at least they would have followed it through. Like, it was just like the poor spider lady, that was it. I was like, oh, for Pete's sakes. Like, oh, come on now.
Oh, I'm sorry, I thought never mind. What I heard was half pizza's sake.
Half pizza's sake, yeah.
And I was just like, well played, Charlie.
Just think of the pizzas. Think of the pizzas.
Someone think of the pizzas.
If there's only half of one, you fold it over, it's a calzone. Oh, the calzone.
But they put cilantro, and I've got that
Low-cal calzone zone. Before we rate this, I have to say very quickly, Ollie and I went to the Mystery Science Theater tour.
Oh, yeah, I saw that they were out
there just after Thanksgiving. Yeah, so this was interesting. This is the first tour that doesn't have any of the original people or any of the new TV cast.
Who is it?
So it's people who have been with Joel on the touring version of the show.
But
Joel's not there anymore. So I was curious to see how it would go. Like, Crow's being voiced by a woman, which took a little bit of an adjustment, but all of the personalities and the characters are really familiar. So, like, and it was funny as fuck. But they did this movie called Making Contact that was directed by Roland Emmerich, who directed Independence Day later.
Oh, shit. I've seen that movie.
You've seen this movie? Jesus Christ. Because it is like, it's like Poltergeist and E.T. jumped in a blender with, like, the dead zone.
And made sure that you just missed the death of your parents, because that was funnier.
And Hellraiser.
That's the one from the 80s. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah, and then, like, it slides into Hellraiser by the end of it. There's a creepy dummy. There's a telekinetic kid. There's,
oh my
like,
God,
the
that's wild.
Trying so hard for the Spielbergian sense of wonder thing. Like, it was the perfect movie for that, but it has a thing at the end where it's like, it's preying on our worst fears. And there's the one fat kid, and he opens the door, and there's a giant giant monster hamburger trying to eat him. And apparently the fat kid's fear is that food will eat him. And if you get a chance to see that movie, you should see
I've just now added it to my, I just put that on a list. Cause I don't know that I even know that it even existed, and Roland Emmerich is a slippery little catfish, so I'll be very fascinated to see that. Mm-hmm.
And if you get a chance to see the MST tour, like, it is every bit what the classic show is. Like, they've proved that they can just take this concept, and if you have really funny, talented people, you can run with it.
Yeah.
Because they're doing live-action puppetry stuff against black screens. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Fun as shit. Anyway, this one is like I couldn't be mad at it. It was just average, you know? It's just like the most down the middle, maybe 4.5, you know, 4.5 out of 10. It's another one of those, like, seems like trying to bring back the 90s style slasher that doesn't make any goddamn sense and you hate the characters. And, like, just maybe don't do that. That's where I'm at.
I think I am right in the same wheelhouse, because the thing this most reminded me of was that remake of Prom Night.
But that was fun, though.
Was it?
I liked it. That was great.
Yeah, you can.
We're talking about the same one, right? The
Chloe
like
Grace Moretz one.
I'm making
the original
a mistake.
Prom Night is a certain thing. Then there was a remake of it in like 2012.
Which one am I? I must be mixing this up, because there was like original Prom Night was Jamie Lee Curtis, and then there was the remake of it.
Oh, but then there was
another one that we watched the remake of.
Exactly, but no.
But Prom Night 2 is fantastic.
There was a full remake of Prom Night starring Chloe Grace Moretz.
But then what's the remake that we watched then? That's the R-rated one where the lady gets the wine bottle down the throat, and then all those like super.
That's House on Sorority vicious. Row, I think.
Sorority Row, thank you.
Okay.
God Almighty, I was mixing Prom Night and Sorority Row.
Ass, yeah.
Because that one is that's what. Sorry, Matt. That was the one I'm thinking of. Sorority Row. That was the one that just rules.
Listen, somewhere between Prom Night and Sorority Row. exists a great death scene.
I will meet you there.
But
meet you in St. Louis. Louis meet
but yeah, I feel like this movie hit the Louis. Meet me at the fair. This one, I felt like, hit the exact sweet spot of a thing existed 30-ish years ago, which we just undercut by making it PG-13 or maybe PG, and re-released by, you know, kind of just cutting its balls off. And, like, this just felt like that kind of movie, right? Where it's like, okay, I get it. This is a Friday the 13th movie. Not a Nightmare on Elm Street movie, because those are where you have to actually care about the kids. But, like, this is a Friday the 13th movie, except they didn't want to get visceral or make you care about anyone. And so I was just bored. And if you're not going to give me the blood and guts, and you're going to bore me because the people aren't interesting, I'm out. So I'm going to say, 2.5. Oh, 2.5, poorly cast, let's say 80s sitcom stars. I feel like that's what they're going for.
Yeah, I'll go. I guess I'll go a little bit higher than this because I mean, so I guess three out of ten. You gotta logic your logic at some points. You gotta logic your logic. Out of ten.
Sure. That's good advice.
That's what I think.
All right, we'll take a quick break and we'll be back with our films for next week. So before we get into next week, I will add the movie that I was trying to remember is called Extremity, and you shouldn't watch it because it was pretty dumb. But for next week, hopefully our movies will not be that dumb. We're going to watch Advent Calendar, that's new on Shudder. We're going to watch Seance on a Wet Afternoon, that is an old movie that is new on HBO Max. And we're going to watch Silent Night, which is from 2021, an incredibly hard title to Google. But it is on Amazon through AMC, so grab your free trial and then get out, because who wants to pay for another fucking subscription? But Silent Night 2021 with Keira Knightley and other folks. So Advent Calendar, Silent Night, Seance on a Wet Afternoon. Our short is Rickety Man, and it will be in the show notes. And I will observe that I have been Josh this entire time and say a good night.
As far as y'all know, I've been Matt this entire time. I heartily recommend watching Advent Calendar as a spoiler, because I enjoyed it, because I watched it 2 days ago. That said, I'm sorry. And good night.
So beautifully weighted. This is Charlie Don Austin. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. And enjoy the films. Also, too, the one that Josh was mentioning about Mr. Science Theater, that's the title Making Contact, or also Joey, which is what what Wikipedia has told me. So that's like I gotta put that in my face, so I gotta figure out how to watch that thing real soon. So all that being said, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, be good to yourselves, and let it ride, and we'll talk to you again soon, and we'll be good, you be good, and we'll talk to you later. Bye bye.
I'm still looking for that goddamn movie. I think it was just called Extreme.
To the extreme, rock like a head.
Light to the stage.
Rock the mic like a vandal. Light to the stage, waxing chumps like a candle. Is that what we're doing?
Uh-huh. Dance. Don't mush the speakers that boom. Yeah, in place of, like, childhood memories, that's what I have.
Yes.
All of the lyrics to all of the songs.